Court is now in session, please be seated.
Ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, my name is Gary Smith, I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bennett. There are three issues in the appeal. The first issue is whether the family court erred in awarding 100% of a marital savings and checking account solely titled in wife's name to wife. The second issue is whether the family court properly calculated the marital portion of the proceeds of the sale of a residence which was jointly owned with the wife's parents. And the third issue is whether the family court erred in its consideration of one of the 11 statutory factors contained in 13 Delaware Code Section 1513 regarding division of marital property, specifically with regard to the factor involving how the assets were acquired and the contributions of the parties to the acquisition of the assets. I would like to begin with issue two, and because that's something that I can address relatively quickly regarding the equity in the marital home. And I have a chart that I've prepared that might help to the court to understand my argument, if I may. I'll pass the chart up to the justices.
Has the other counsel seen it?
Yes, Your Honor. And I've given Mr. Eaton a copy. Do you have a copy, Mike?
Yes, I have.
Thank you.
It illustrates the argument I made in the brief, nothing new.
What we have, Your Honors, is a home that was purchased during the marriage jointly with the wife's parents. So we have two transactions here. One is the purchase of the home. As you can see by line one, the purchase price was $122,900, and the cost to purchase the property was $6,463. Therefore, the total purchase cost of that home was $129,363. The parents contributed $49,363. So therefore, their contribution to the overall purchase was 38.16%. Similarly, the parties, specifically the wife, contributed a mortgage of $80,000, which means that her contribution to the purchase of the home was 61.84%.
I thought the essence of your argument was that the calculation by the family court was improper because it didn't account for the parent's share of the cost of the sale of the property. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Isn't it the case that those costs were not included in the sale price of the house from which the family court calculated the rate of return?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Isn't it the case that those costs were not included in the sale price of the house from which the family court calculated the rate of return?
The sale costs were not included in the way the family court, part of the sale costs were included and part were not included. That's one of the reasons that I'm not clear on how the family court arrived at the answer.
Part of the costs were included and part were not?
I believe the family court included only $2,000 of the costs, according to the decision. It's hard to read, it's in a footnote.
Well, I thought the thrust of your argument was that you wanted the percentages based on the gross and that the family court used the net, and you thought that's what led to the disparity. Is that part of the problem?
Well, the problem is that when you purchase a house, you incur costs. When you sell a house, you incur costs. My position, Mr. Bennett's position, was that those costs should be shared proportionally to the contributions to purchasing the home. and they were not.
Well, the question then becomes, is that an error of law or abuse of discretion when you do it a different way?
Well, my response to that would be, this is a calculation that is amenable to a specific amount of money. It's not sort of a discretionary decision that a family court judge has some leeway. I mean, I think there's a $5,000 difference here. I guess you could say in family court work that's close enough. But again, this is a calculation.
I'm not trying to say it's close enough because this case is unusual in the sense that there's some effort to make parents whole for their contribution. And in most of the cases we see on appeal, the equity goes much more to the parties than it does to the parents. And the point I'm trying to make in my question is, help us understand the precedent we're establishing, because if there are multiple ways to reimburse people in circumstances like this, I understand you disagree with the method the trial court used. Tell us how it constitutes reversible error, either because it was legally wrong or it was abuse of discretion.
I would answer that this way, Your Honor. The cost of purchase and sale have to be accounted for in the way the equity is calculated. And I believe that it was not done properly by the family court. And I don't mean to not directly address Justice Jacobs' question, but if I can proceed with this, I think it will become relatively clear what I'm getting at. When the house was sold, it was sold for $156,900, and the parties received a credit of $876 for overpaid taxes and sewer charges. Therefore, the gross amount that they were due was $157,776. The cost of sale was $12,155, and therefore the proportionate share of the parents' cost was $4,638, and the proportionate share of the wife's cost were $7,517. So the calculation is very simple from there. You take the gross sales price times the parents' percentage, and they're entitled to $59,873 minus their proportionate share of the cost, which allows them a total amount of $55,235. Now, the parties' calculation is the same thing using their percentage of interest. They're entitled to 61.84%, or $97,027, minus the proportionate share of their cost, minus the mortgage that had to be paid off by the wife, leaving $21,156. Now, in this example, I included the adjustment for the sewer and taxes on the wife's side of the calculation, leaving a balance of $22,432. And if you add what the wife is entitled to, $22,432, to what the parents are entitled to, you get exactly what the net amount the sellers received on the settlement sheet, $77,667. So I think this is the appropriate way, and I'm sure that the family court is confronted with this issue frequently, that parties own property jointly with non-parties, and they have to have a method of calculating what part is marital. And I think that this is the appropriate way to do it.
Well, and so I go back to my question. In reading the judge's decision denying your motion for re-argument, in the paragraph where she responds to your argument, what she basically said is she deducted the cost of the sale and then multiply the percentage that she was going to give to the parties. And what you would want her to do is the decide what cost each party should bear first. Is that right?
It should be the same. My argument with the judge was that she had not deducted enough of the cost, that the figure that she used was incorrect. As you can see from this calculation, the cost in purchasing the property are really not part of the calculation in calculating the equity. That's only used in calculating the percentage of the interest that they have in the property. The only costs that are really relevant to this calculation are the sale costs. So the calculation is very simple. The sales price times the percentage of interest minus the proportionate share of the cost. And it makes a $5,000 difference in the calculation. It's very difficult to explain. I've spent many hours trying to go through this.
Let me, despite the nostalgia of listening to all these numbers, and it takes me back to the early 80s and late 70s of my own practice, go back to Justice Holland's question. We try to approach these cases by first deciding whether or not the argument is that the judge has erred as a matter of law because in apportioning marital property, the judge failed to conduct the multi-factor analysis that's required by Section 1513. If that's not the argument, but the argument is that the judge indulged in that analysis as the statute demands, they simply got it wrong when they did so. And that is examined under an abuse of discretion standard rather than a de novo you've erred as a matter of law standard. Am I correct that your argument is the judge did engage in the multi-factor analysis but simply got it wrong when the judge apportioned the property in the way in which she did?
Well, there's two ways to answer that question. One is the court has to decide what is marital property in the first place. And then the second question is how that property is to be divided. I think that in this example of the house equity, she erred in calculating what portion was marital, and I believe that's a question of law. With regard to how it was divided, that's the argument or the issue number three with regard to whether Mr. Bennett was entitled to 40% or 50%, something like that. So two issues. One, what is marital property? Two, how is that property to be divided? This issue that I'm talking about now about the house primarily involves what portion of it is marital. And
So in your view, that's a question of law?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That addresses that issue about the house equity. I want to move on to my other issues. The first issue that was argued was whether or not the court erred in awarding 100% of the wife's solely owned bank accounts to wife. The court referred to an unreported family court decision, Asse Afre, in supporting its decision that since the wife always maintained this as separate property, as a matter of fact, the parties in the Bennett case maintained all of their financial dealings separately.
The property has, there's a presumption that the property is marital unless it's shown clearly to be separate. Is that right?
That's correct.
So if, for example, not this case, but in some other case, the husband and wife actually contracted between themselves that certain property would be individually owned, the court would respect that.
That's correct. That's one of the exceptions to marital property contained in the statute,
okay.
Valid agreement of the parties.
And if instead of a written contract, the parties had a practice of keeping their accounts separate throughout the entire marriage, the result would be the same.
I disagree. The court...
Isn't that Bennett?
Pardon me?
Isn't that the case that the court relied on?
Let me get the name of it. Osei Afriye?
That's the unreported family court case that the court below relied upon.
So the parties had an understanding that resulted, without any exception, in the bank accounts being kept separately with no intermingling. You're saying that would not be, that should not be respected by the court as an instance of separate property?
Absolutely not. The Assay-Opre case did not stand for the proposition the family court used. The Assay-Opre case simply was, the judge, it really was dicta, said, you know, the parties have equal assets, they both have equal right to.
All right, is it your position then that nothing short of a formal written agreement would suffice to establish separate property and defeat the presumption that the property is marital?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Should be a written pre- or post-nuptial agreement or some other type of valid written agreement, because I don't think, and the important point here is, a party can inadvertently or unintentionally waive their marital property rights by some. And in this particular case, the testimony is quite clear that there's never any discussion about the legal effect of these separate accounts. It was an informal arrangement.
Well, how do you, and I don't want to use up your rebuttal time, but in looking at the decision denying your motion for re-argument, the court has an alternative basis for the holding, which are this paragraph of equitable consideration. Why wouldn't that be an independent basis to affirm what she did?
Because, frankly, there's no equitable basis to do that. The equity, as a matter of fact, favors Mr. Bennett in the sense that he's the more, I guess, the party in a lesser favorable economic position.
Yeah, I thought the record showed that the wife had a serious illness and she was caring for her daughter with a serious illness.
The record did not reflect that, Your Honor. The record reflects that the wife said she had a serious illness. There's no doctor's testimony. There's no medical records. This is silly, uncorroborated, self-serving testimony by the wife. As a matter of fact, I believe the testimony shows that she hadn't even missed any or fairly few days from work in the 12 and a half years that they were married due to this medical condition. It is true that the party's son has cerebral palsy and does require very, aggressive type of care, and that's a significant burden on the caretaker. But that's not an issue in dividing marital property, I would say. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Bennett attempted to put all Mr. Bennett's money he was awarded into a trust in the family court, as you can see, said that that was not available to her.
But we're aware of the fact, her position on the record was that he shouldn't get anything at all.
That's correct.
You have 2 minutes left for rebuttal. Do you want to reserve it?
2 minutes left for rebuttal?
Right.
Yes, that's all. I'd like to reserve it. Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen. I am Edward Eaton. I'm here to argue the case of Sheila Bennett, the appellee. I'd like to start by thanking the court for giving us an extension at the last minute to enable us to file the brief. I know that's rare, and we appreciate the courtesy. Not sure. There's lots of things I'd like to dive into since we were having a discussion, but I think I should start by saying that If it wasn't the appellant's position at trial that Mrs. Bennett had illnesses, I think it's pretty clear from the decision that the court made findings of fact that she had osteoarthritis, osteoporosis, I think it is, something called Sjögren's syndrome, which apparently is an autoimmune deteriorating joint syndrome, and lupus. So I think the record would support that the court determined for purposes of it, of weighing the equities, that she had an illness that was causing her to have a problem caring for her. And I believe it's a son, not a daughter, Andrew. Also, Andrew, of course, has cerebral palsy, and so it is true that the court it's true to say that the court, in weighing the equities and the factor that talks about determining the relative health and well-being and ability to earn assets in the future and that sort of thing, made a determination in favor of life because of her problems going forward. In fact, when the court divided the
Mr. Eaton, the first question is, were the accounts marital or separate?
I had some trouble with that when I was reviewing this record, Your Honor. As you know, I was not the attorney in the hearing below. I believe that the judge's decision did not say that the accounts were non-marital. And I believe O.C. Afferi does not stand for the proposition that these bank accounts are non-marital. It simply says sometimes if the parties throughout the marriage are treating these accounts in a certain way, it's equitable to continue that and to award the accounts in their entirety to the party in whose name they are.
Even if the accounts are marital?
Well, even if they aren't, but I don't think that the judge...
Even if
they are marital, that's right. Even if they are marital, and I believe that the opinion, because of the equities that she considers when just trying to decide what to do with this...
Well, should we assume for purposes of this case that the court found that the property was marital, but simply allocated the accounts in a way that was different from the formula?
That's how I read it, Your Honor.
Okay, then would the claim that the judge committed error in that regard, would that be an error of law or an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think it would be under the category of abuse of discretion if the court determined that the way that the court below weighed the equities.
And your position is that there was no abuse of discretion?
My position is there was no abuse of discretion.
Why not?
Because the court, a reading of both the, we have the benefit of both an opinion and a decision on re-argument, and they're, I mean, not that the decisions that you get are not always carefully worded and exhaustive, but I think the court went through all the facts very, very carefully and showed a real clear understanding of what happened. In other words...
Would you share that understanding with us and tell us why there is no abuse of discretion?
The understanding was that during the course of the marriage, the parties had an agreement that these funds would be kept separate. There's testimony in the record that my wife, on two occasions at least, where she said, yes, we had an agreement, we were going to keep them separate. Husband's testimony was, well, we never really talked about it, we just did it. So I believe that the court believed wife and found that there was an agreement from the outset to keep the funds separate. By keeping the funds separate, that meant that husband received his funds from his employment, kept them to himself, and the record shows to use, he admitted on the record, he would use them for his enjoyment and gave some money to wife from which she paid his high car insurance, his car payment or truck payment, I forget which, and newspapers and groceries. During the course of the marriage, wife paid all the bills. The reason they did this was husband had terrible credit. Wife wanted to maintain her credit. Husband had child support payments due from children from a prior marriage. At one point, a joint tax refund was seized to pay for these child support payments, so the parties started filing separate accounts, separate tax returns.
If property is marital, is there a rule that says that property has to be allocated according to a formula?
No, I think that the court can, and frequently does, separate out certain parts of the property before determining the allocation of whether it's 60-40 or 50-50 or 70-30. The court may say, well, I'm awarding this for as long as they give an underlying basis, as long as they show their reasoning and that they're not just doing it on a whim, that the court may say, you're going to get this, and you're going to get this, and I'm going to divide the rest of these assets up in this manner. The court, when looking at the factors in 1513, and if you look in the opinion, the court actually mentioned the determination that White would get all of the 100% of the bank accounts when they talked about the one factor that she found which favored husband, which was factor number seven, I believe, which is the assets that are set apart to each of the parties. And the court below ruled, well, I'm giving her all of the bank accounts, so obviously this factor favors him when I'm looking at how to divide this property, the rest of the property up. At the beginning of that section where she discusses the factors, she starts by saying something to the effect of, now that we've made a determination of which assets we're going to divide by the formula versus which assets I'm setting apart for the parties separately, let me move on to that. But in the process of going through all the factors, she does consider the bank accounts. And so I think it's part of a deliberative process where she's taken it into account when she makes the final division. I think what's really present in this case is a judge who sees a party who's in real need of help in the future, whose health is failing, who has a son with cerebral palsy, and determines that she's going to look at the reality of their life together and set apart assets that will benefit both of them appropriately.
So property that's at issue in a property division context can be treated in one of three ways. It can be treated as non-marital if the court finds that it's non-marital, in which case it goes to the spouse that owns it. Or it can be marital, but the court can carve that property out nonetheless from the operation of the formula if the court makes a determination that it's appropriate to do so.
Well, so long
yes
as,
or no?
No. No, the answer is no. As long the court still is required to look at all marital property within Section 1513, it has to look at those factors and apply them to all the marital property. But in doing so, it may say, I'm going to give you all this. I'm going to give you some of this, and I'm going to divide the rest in this fashion. And I think that's what happened here.
Well, there has to be some rationalization by the court about why X asset was set aside, but then there was an adjustment made in the balance of the Y assets that compensates for that on the overall equitable formula, correct?
I agree with you, and I think that's where the O.C. Affery case comes in. The judge is saying that this isn't the first time this has been done. Judge Nicholas did it in 1997 or 8 in his opinion, which is very similar to the opinion to the case I have here. The parties during the entire course of their marriage kept their funds totally separate and apart. That's what happened here. It's not that common for that to happen. And she said this is how it was handled there, and I think that's an appropriate way of dealing with these accounts again here.
But, I mean, aren't you saying that as to some property that's marital, the court can simply decide, I'm not going to apply the formula literally to that property?
I don't think I'm saying that. I think that the court has a duty to apply the factors to all the items of marital property. What I'm really saying is that I think that if you a careful reading of this decision is that the court did apply all the factors, although it may have dealt with the items of property first and then gone on to this determination of the factors. But even after it went on to the determination of the factors, it included into that determination the recognition of the 100% allocation of the bank accounts in factor number 7 and said this favors husband. But it went on to say that the other two, that factors 3 and 6 favor wife and 6 strongly favors wife. Should I move on to another issue? With regard to the house proceeds, I think there's the flaws that are present in Mr. Smith's argument are that he's viewing wife as having contributed $80,000 to the purchase of this house. That's one of the flaws. And she didn't really contribute $80,000. A bank contributed $80,000. She signed on a dotted line on the note and mortgage along with her parents, or I guess her parents, I'm sorry, strike that. She signed on the dotted line to a mortgage, but her parents really contributed the lion's share of the money that allowed that house to be purchased. And when the court looked at how the assets should be divided, how the proceeds should be divided, they adopted the formula that was put forward by Weiss, and I encourage Your Honors to reread those letters that appear at the end of Weiss' appendix that were relied upon by the court and find it make the determination. She looked at the net sales proceeds, and then she looked at the amount of the contribution of the parents initially, and that's how she determined the percentage of their investment in this, in the, their investment. And she looked at the ratio between the sales, the net sales proceeds, and the contribution initially to determine the rate of return, and she applied that rate of return to the initial investment by the parents. Another flaw that I see in the in this handout that was given is that there were three parties involved: husband, wife, and daughter. And the court divided made a determination that the proceeds should be divided three ways, not two ways. Mr. Bennett would rather see it divided in half, in two ways, and that's how he's factored it in here. And of course, the third factor again is his calculation is double dipping in that it wants you to go back and put the sales costs back into the formula where they were already included in the net proceeds, so they've already been factored into the process when the determination was made.
So are we talking about an abuse of discretion claim?
We're talking about whether or not the court had the discretion to adopt one or the other proposed formulas. She chose the formula put forward by Weiss, and I think with good reason. It bears noting that over the course of this, the ownership of this house, Weiss paid something along the lines of one-fourth of the amount of money towards it that her parents have paid. And yet, under this formula, Mr. Bennett would have Weiss' share be determined to be 61.84% and parents' contribution to be 38.16%, when in fact, when you look at the actual cash outlay during the course of this process, the parents contributed four times as much as their daughter.
Are you saying that under Mr. Smith's calculation, or the one that he advocates for, if the court were to accept that, then Mr. Bennett would end up with a percentage of the parents' equity in the house?
Yes, I am.
But under the formulas applied by the court, how is that equity disposed of or allocated?
Under the formula as it's applied by the court utilized a procedure that accurately measures how much the parents put forward toward the total investment by simply starting with the amount they put in and looking at the amount that was realized at the end of the line and then taking the ratios from that instead of throwing in other factors that were already factored out. It bears mention, I think, that the this house has another function in this whole argument, and that is when looking at the ultimate decision of the court to divide the marital proceeds 60-40, which is another one of the issues in this case. The court relied heavily on wife's contribution to the marriage during the marriage, and there's an issue about whether or not the ability of the parties to live in this house should be deemed a contribution by wife. And in her motion for re-argument, the judge emphasized that because Mr. Bennett had argued she shouldn't really get credit for this because it was her parents' money that really enabled this to happen, and then they got their money back. But really, the judge says, look, they never would have lived in this house if it hadn't been for her and her parents, and she she should be given the benefit of that as a strong factor, because it greatly improved the party's life during the marriage. Also, I think trying to say that, well, it was all the parents, not her, on the one hand, and then when you're trying to divide up the proceeds, well, it's mostly her and not the parents. Sort of the two arguments are sort of antithetic to each other, if that's a word. Antithetical. In any case, I think that her decision to divide the marital property 60-40, whether another judge might have chosen to do it another way or not, is clearly based upon a careful and deliberative approach. She went through all the factors, she analyzed the factors and how to apply them. She clearly set forth her reasons, both in her decision below and in her motion for, in her decision on the motion for re-argument. And I would encourage the court not to disturb those decisions. I'll give up the rest of my time unless there are any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. In closing, I'd like to say that this case really turns family law jurisprudence upside down in a sense, because it benefits the person with the greater earning capacity at the expense of the person who sacrificed and stayed at home with a disabled child. Normally, in a normal situation, you would see that the inferior person would have received the greater proportion of the marital assets. Secondly, it would be, I would submit to the court, a terrible precedent to allow a party through their own mechanisms of shielding assets or titling in separate names to exclude that, or to say that it is permissible to award 100% of those assets to that party. I can see people with high paying jobs setting up their own accounts as soon as the court were to rule that way. I hope that that wouldn't happen. As far as I know, there are no reported or unreported decisions that have permitted that. Certainly one cannot inadvertently or unintentionally waive a marital property interest, and that's basically what would happen if that type of asset were awarded to the other party. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.